Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, to find common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. As has been said, this show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. It's my hope that you will come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. You may or you may not agree with things that are said. What I'd ask you to do is keep that open mind. This way you can see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now, today my guest is J.J. Semple. He is the author of 3 best-selling nonfiction books dealing with energy cultivation techniques, Kundalini, meditation consciousness, alchemy, sexual sublimation, and mindfulness, and their effect on human evolution. His first book, Deciphering the Golden Flower, One Secret at a Time, is an autobiographical memoir of his Kundalini awakening. His second book, The Backward Flowing Method, The Secret of Life and Death, takes an expanded look at an optimal method for activating Kundalini in a safe, permanent, and repeatable fashion over the course of a single lifetime. The Biology of Consciousness, Case Studies in Kundalini, examines the paranormal aspects of consciousness and its relation to human biology and to the transmission of paranormal abilities to future generations through DNA. J.J. Semple's formal education includes studying English literature at the University of Pennsylvania and George Washington University, and he has a master's degree in marketing from Haute Etudes de Commerce in Paris. His personal education involves yogic and paranormal practices and exploration inspired by a wide variety of teachers, writers, and philosophers, including Gopi Krishna Milarepa, Carl Gustav Jung, and Leo Tolstoy and Lao Tse. He is the founder of Life Force Books, a publishing company featuring books on the neuroplasticity aspects of Kundalini and helpful guidelines for living with Kundalini. His Golden Flower Meditation Method, GFM, is practiced by adepts all over the world. In addition, he teaches seminal retention techniques for facilitating the Kundalini process. And so I'd like to introduce J.J. Semple. How are you, J.J.?
I'm fine today. Thank you very much, David.
Thank you very much. I am very interested in examining the paranormal aspects of consciousness and its relation to human biology. I wondered if that would be a good starting point, and then maybe we could talk about your autobiographical memoir and go from there.
That's fine. Let's take the notion or the word, the term spiritual. For many people who first get into spiritual investigation, who are pulled into it by whatever motivations they may have in their personal life, whether it's exterior or whatever they feel, at first they don't have any kind of bodily sensations or anything related to anatomy or metabolism or the somatic aspects of the human body. As you get into it, especially through meditation and yoga, you may begin to feel these things. That's because they're tied to a secret biology within our body that's known by the term Kundalini. You can get converted to a religion. You can't get converted to Kundalini any more than you can get converted to an orgasm or a heart attack. These are biological features. We all know about heart attacks and orgasms, but many of us don't know anything about Kundalini. Kundalini is a subsystem in the body that opens up a pathway to greater consciousness. Basically, how it works is that you awaken this reserve of energy through meditation and other practices, and I won't go into right now, that's located in the base of the spine. Slowly that climbs the spine through a central channel that's unknown to standard medicine. And when that reaches the brain, it erupts into and opens up the chakras, and that, again, it's another Indian term, and starts remaking the being. And when I say being, I hope to include the body, the mind, the spirit, all aspects of our anatomy, such that the person who started out is no longer the same person. Now, this process, many people that know something about Kundalini think that this process is instantaneous. It isn't. It takes a long time. But once it happens, once Kundalini becomes active, you can't go back. There's no back way. You can't back out of it. It triggers autonomic self-healing mechanisms capable of correcting defects related to neural degeneration, because Kundalini uses the nervous system both to feel out or investigate any deformities or neural problems, and that any areas in the body to which neural energy can be communicated, Kundalini does an overview of the body. It rejuvenates the body, retards the aging process, reverses self-destructive and addictive behavior. In other words, people that go into these to spiritual pursuits, a lot of them are still smoking dope or drinking or whatever, and they bump along, and they go to a yoga class, and they come home and have a martini and or a couple of beers, and they think it's the two aren't related. Well, they are, because if you get into to Kundalini, Kundalini will turn you off that, not because you're fighting it, but because you'll no longer need it. It will just drop away of its own accord. All addictions. Kundalini heightens and enhances consciousness to effect a release from karmic bondage, so that we know that there's no such thing as death, that death is just a cycle in a whole state of being that repeats and repeats itself. And in that state, the host, if you would, of that state is an all-pervasive consciousness to which we learn that we are part of. It allows the individual to face death without fear and facilitates the transition to that state of being. So that's how I think it's related to biology. It starts with this little kernel of biology, which is this hidden center at the base of the spine that's awakened through the breathing practices associated with meditation, climbs the spine into the brain, opens up the different chakras that have, they're sort of equivalent to the glandular system in Western medicine, but not entirely. Now, a common link between Western medicine and Eastern medicine, Chinese medicine or Indian medicine, known to us in the West, is acupuncture. We haven't actually scientifically proven why and how acupuncture works. We know only that it does work. Well, it's working on these chakras and on this secret subsystem of the body. So sooner or later, we will be able to reveal this system. So many people are working on it to that end. And Gopi Krishna, the person you mentioned in the introduction, was, I would say, the leading writer researcher on Kundalini in the 20th century. And now many, many people are carrying on this research, and I've been doing it for the last 40 years.
Well, it sounds fascinating. I'm especially interested in the Kundalini awakening that you experienced and what somebody like me or anyone can do to awaken their Kundalini. I mean, it sounds like meditation is a good means for opening that chakra, but I imagine there's a lot more to it than that.
My first book is a memoir, Deciphering the Golden Flower, and that's my case study, if you would, of leading from my birth almost right through to the activation of Kundalini and then life after and adjusting to it. So many readers just can identify with that. If they're into character-driven literature, if you read, I don't know, Tolstoy or Hemingway, and you like that, if you don't like it, it's hard to identify with a memoir. But this book has been quite successful. It's really down to earth. It chronicles all my faults and failures and how I snapped back and ultimately found this other aspect. Again, I'll stay away from the word spiritual, other aspect of my being, and used it to completely change my whole being. Now, my last book, The Biology of Consciousness, Case Studies in Kundalini, features 9 different ways in which Kundalini are triggered. So that kind of addresses that part of your last question about how many different ways. And each one is a lengthy case study in there. And they run the gamut from meditation, obviously, to Shaktipat, which is the conference of Kundalini by a guru. Now, I have not had that done, and I couldn't have it done because it's already active, so I can't go back to that point in my life before it was active and go and then have it conferred and then go forward. You probably understand that. But I have talked to people who claim that that's been done. Now, I believe it's possible. There is a downside to it that I see, and that is that it's temporary. People snap out of it, but they leave part of themselves in that world, and they're always wanting to get back to it. So it can be a real interference. And that covers the last part of that book that I just mentioned, covers that whole aspect of living with Kundalini, that it's not a walk in the park, that it takes a strong personality and a strong the ability to bounce back, to not master it, but to give into it. Other ways are just through sexual intercourse, through meditation I mentioned, through there are many instances of drugs, and there are many instances of people just walking down the street or sitting in their living room watching TV, and all of a sudden something happens. This amazing energy starts to be noticed, actually physically, palpably noticed in the lower belly, and it surges up the spine. All of these different triggers, I talk about triggers and effects. The triggers are the way that Kundalini is activated. The effects are what happens in each individual case once the Kundalini is triggered. So the effects are so varied. You can compare this with near-death experience. Near-death experience has a subset of Kundalini effects, but they're usually always the same. You take reports from all over the world, different cultures, different languages, different personalities, and people talk about the same thing. With Kundalini, people don't necessarily share all the effects or even the same subset of effects. So each case is very different. The worst thing somebody can do, I think, from all my research, that if they activate Kundalini, either voluntarily or involuntary, is once it happens to be overwhelmed and to try to fight it. You cannot fight it. You must submit. That just means, and how do you do that? Well, when it happened to me, it is like a star shower inside your body with all kinds of channels hidden, pumping energy into your brain, and the brain then sending it back through other nerve channels to where it's needed for that particular stage in your development. Let me give you a quick example. When
sure.
it happened to me, I was able to see inside my brain, able to observe these comings and goings, and the chakra in the front, the I think it's called the Ajna chakra, which is the third eye, opened up, and it was like a castanet, and shaped like a castanet, and it spray, it turned around, and it would spray this energy, vital energy, fluid, sweet smelling almost like honey on different parts of my brain. And because I had fasted for almost 2 weeks before, I was really I was very tired and didn't have a lot of energy. So at one point I could see my solar plexus open up that separate and a force field of energy shoot out of my body through the air into the third eye chakra, which the castanet opened to receive it and then turned around and sprayed it on parts of my brain to supply it with the necessary energy to complete the process. So that's most people, they're listening to this, they say, this guy's crazy, this can't happen, it'll never happen to me. Well, probably it won't, because I talk always about permanent kundalini, and meditation is the only way that I've seen time after time of people being able to open it permanently. I'm not saying that it can't happen permanently by other means, but I've only witnessed permanent activations that were triggered by meditation, and Gopi Krishna is one of those, and he wrote a book called Kundalini, the Evolutionary Energy in Man, which is the same kind of personal memoir as my Deciphering the Golden Flower, his to the Indian culture and tradition, mine to the American and the Western tradition. And so that's basically it on that side there.
Is there any specific form of meditation that you would recommend? Or for people that have never meditated before, would you be able to suggest a technique that would be easy for them to try out?
Well, let's take a step back in the history of meditation. During the, I guess it was the 1970s, there was a doctor at Harvard who, I forgot his name now, he kind of brought, he called it the, forget it. Anyway, he brought this system of meditation. It was basically a two-step method. My method, Golden Flower Meditation, is a three-step method, and I'll get into that just to compare. His method was basically, he saw meditation as a way of reducing stress, and it certainly is, but it can go much further if you're willing to take that route and to potentially risk it, because nothing in this, all of this work is guaranteed, either success, or if you achieve success, that you're able to control it or live with it or whatever you want to say, just handle it, manage it, or let it manage you without fighting it. So his method consisted of diaphragmatic deep breathing and control of the heart rate. And you use one as a handle to achieve the other. In other words, you can't just give the heart a message from your brain and say, okay, I want you to beat slower. It's not going to work. You can't control the heart by the mind, but you can control it through the breathing. So basically what you do is you learn to breathe slowly, silently, by using the abdomen and the diaphragm. Now, a turtle breathes 3 times a minute. An adult human being breathes 20 times a minute. So the turtle must be doing something right, and we must be doing something wrong, because longevity is tied to the cycle of breaths. Mm. So slower we breathe, you breathe, not just the longer you're going to live, but the more you get, you begin to enter that domain that I talked about at the beginning of recognizing events or sensations in the body, things that you've never been able to recognize before. You slow the breath down such that in a silent room, in a quiet room, you can't hear yourself breathing. This achieves eventually a wake up of energy near the coccyx at the base of the spine. Once you feel that energy, you can control it. Now, his system, the Harvard doctor that brought that, it's called the relaxation response. Once you're able to do that and slow down the heart rate, well, you've to some degree you've conquered stress, because you can mentally then get back to that state. Let's say you're in the bank and the line is going slow, and it's Friday afternoon. You want to get to the train to get home. You're out of you know the expression, like, he was beside himself. Well, you're not only beside yourself in that situation, you're actually up there at the counter mentally involving yourself with the clerk and hurrying him and trying to even take over his job mentally, but you can't. So what you need to do is what the Gurdjieff called is remember yourself, which is, I am here, I am me, I am standing right here, to slow down, and then I want to go back to that state, and then you can slow it down, because you're not doing any yourself any good. You're not going to speed the line up by getting upset or nervous or anxious. So you remain within yourself, and that's what that relaxation response does. It allows you to learn that state is possible and that you can get back to it. So it helps you manage stress. Now, he brought this system back from the Orient, but he neglected to bring the third step, which is the backward flowing method. The backward flowing method details that once you feel that energy arousal in the base of the spine, that you sublimate it. It's basically a type of distilled sexual energy, and you sublimate it, meaning you then steer it up the spine into the brain. And so you have a conflict here between normal sexual activity and sublimation. It's very hard to achieve this kundalini activation if you're out there practicing heavy sexual intercourse or activity. It's just not going to work. So that's another trade-off that most people want to think twice about. Do I want to get into this and have to give up my sexual life? That works its way in. So that's this method, Golden Flower Meditation. It entails all that. Each step, you have to master each step in turn. You can't jump to the backward flowing method. It won't work. But each step is a handle to the next. And once you can't achieve control, you can't control heart rate without the breathing, and you can't perceive the energy buildup without slowing down the heart. So once you do that, and that you do feel that energy, then you actually have the choice of, say, okay, I'm going to decide right now to start sending it up the back. When you do sense it, the energy, you'll see that it has the property of direction down the back and up the front. So what you're going to do then is you're going to tell yourself, I want that energy to move down the front and up the back, and it will obey. But it's a huge step, because you can't turn back.
Wow. Well, I'm curious about the sublimation of sexuality, expression of sexuality. I've had a past history of sexual addiction, so I'm sure that my kundalini was fast asleep. And now I'm embarking on a different path. I recently was married, but I am not sexual very often. And so I'm very interested in exploring this for myself, as I imagine is the caller that's on the line. What would you suggest I do besides the meditation? I know you've talked about nine things. Practically, what would be the best thing for me to do?
Well, I have a whole... I've written extensively on that subject in my book, on my blog, and in my website. And I'll try to find that. And let me just quote this from you. This is from The Secret of the Golden Flower. An ancient adept said, "Formerly, every school knew of this jewel. Only fools did not know it wholly." If we reflect on that, we see that the ancients attained long life by the help of the seed energy present in their own bodies and did not lengthen their years by swallowing this or that type of elixir. But the worldly people lost the roots and clung to the treetops. Basically, when they talk about the seed energy, they're talking about this elixir and the sublimation of it. This book was written in the 6th century. And before that, it existed in oral form for many, many centuries. So this is nothing new. Now, I would say that let me after the show, I'll send you the links to those two. There's a blog post and some web pages specifically on that. And
that would be great.
It's a very and there's also one on sexual. I have a blog. Entry on overcoming sexual addiction through sublimation. Because what do we do normally? What are we told to do when we have a sexual addiction problem? We're told to listen to the little voice in the back of the head that somehow we're going to dominate it. But that's a very mental process, and it's usually unsuccessful, because just like anything with any kind of addiction, the addiction is stronger than our mental capability of dealing with it. Why? Because we're all seeking that release of dopamine. Addictions don't take place in the penis or the pocketbook if you're a shopper. They take place in the brain, because the longing for the dopamine release. So all addictions are related to dopamine. What this does is it raises consciousness to the point where you no longer need the dopamine release, because you've replaced it with the kundalini, the release of this distilled sexual energy that's gone to the brain. Now, you have to give up. There's a trade-off. You have to give up sexual relations. But look it, I'm 77 years old. I don't care. I mean, I've had children, and I've had enough sex to last 5 lifetimes. You probably have. But if I'm 35 years old or 40, then it becomes dicey. Well, I was 35, and I learned. That's why I teach a course, and I'm coming out with a new book entitled "Seminal Retention and Higher Consciousness: The Sexology of Kundalini." Because basically that is how to master how to deal with contradiction. The fact that if you want to attain some measure of or higher consciousness, or you're interested in it, or you want to meditate, or you want to practice some yogic form, if not necessarily golden flower meditation, but something, and you know that it involves a trade-off of conserving sexual energy, but you still want to have sex, how can you do it? Well, that's the whole thing with learning seminal retention. And I also have a post on that, and I'll send you that link too.
Great.
Now this applies to women in some of the same ways it applies to men. Obviously, men, ejaculation is a physical process that involves a lot of energy transference. People don't think of it that way. They just think, oh, I feel good. That was great. I love that. But you're actually just like that quote from the that I read you there from the backward flowing method. That's the same thing. They attain long life by the help of the seed energy present in their bodies. That's it. That's the key to it. But why do people become addicted? Because they're looking for real-time satisfaction, not for long-term. They're not thinking about, hey, I want to live 100 years or I want to live 90 years and I want to be healthy when I'm 75. So they smoke a lot, and, well, along 60 years old, they've got emphysema or lung cancer or something like that, and there's payback time. And I think in the future, we're going to be called on to manage our bodies and our health individually a lot more than we are now. It's already started. When I was 25, I'd go to the doctor, and you could hardly spit out what was wrong with you, because they'd shut you up immediately and come on like, I'm the expert. How dare you be involved in this? Well, now doctors, they're opening up a lot more, and they're asking you to speak about your symptoms and what's bothering you. And I think this is going to continue and grow, not only because of the rising cost of medicine, but just because we're a more synergistic society. More people know about the things that you talked about in the preamble of your show. More people feel this connectedness and want to find a way to actually live it.
Well, you know, one of the things that you talked about earlier in the show that I'd like to explore, and then we'll bring the caller on the line. You talked about, in essence, as I understood it, overcoming karmic influences. Can you address that some more?
Okay. Let's see. I think I said something like...
I'm paraphrasing.
Heightens and enhances consciousness to the effect to effect release from karmic bondage. I'm reading this off the back of my book as a bullet point on the back cover.
Okay.
Basically, this ties into the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Once you activate Kundalini, these books, they're not opaque any longer. Books like the Tibetan Book of the Dead. I read the Tibetan Book of the Dead before I was I activated Kundalini, and it was I read a lot of books, and I knew that they felt, or that something must be out there for all these people, because they were writing about it, and I had taken LSD and I'd felt tremors of a conscious shift of consciousness, but I didn't actually I had never actually experienced it for myself, and that's the big difference. Once you activate Kundalini, you know there's no such thing as death. So it's like, okay, this is I can see my karma. I can move forward without feeling held to any kind of strict karma that's going to somehow hem me in. And let me read another passage. It's at the
sure.
It's a quote from a book called The Alchemy of Desire by Tarun J. Tejpal, an Indian author. The greatest book in the world, the Mahabharata, tells us we all have to live and die by our karmic cycle. Thus works the perfect reward and punishment, cause and effect, code of the universe. We live out in our present life what we wrote out in our last, but the great moral thriller also orders us to rage against karma and its despotic dictates. It teaches us to subvert it, to change it. It tells us we also write out our next lives as we live out our present. To me, that speaks very true, that you see the possibility of writing out your future life, that there's a connectedness, that everything you do here is going to influence your future life, and you're going to know about these different stages of the bardos, as they're referred to in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, before you actually get into them. You're going to know, you're not going to be surprised. I mean, the big thing in the Tibetan Book of the Dead is the instant of death, that the deceased hovers around his body and witnesses the lamentations and the crying and the relatives and all that type of stuff. And it takes quite a while to get away to separate from the body, even though you're deceased. Whereas if you know that process, you go towards the light. If you understand that process, you've already trained yourself in the meditation that you've done and the work with Kundalini, so that there's no interruption. There's no karmic bondage. It's not, you don't hold fast to your former life. It's past, but you've learned from it. You've mastered it, and you've defied it. Let's say you started out. There's nothing to say that a criminal that can't defy karma and progress through this cycle. I mean, we look at these things as very finite, like he's a criminal, he's in jail, he's done that, he'll never, we don't want him around. But he's going to continue his karmic cycle just like all of us.
Well, would you mind putting out your website? Is that the best way for people to get in touch with you?
Yeah. I mean, there's all sorts of ways in the website, yeah. It'll take me a minute to do that after the show, though, because I've got to track down all these links. I got a lot of stuff on the web.
Hello? Okay. Excuse my dog in the background. I operate out of my home. Well, shall we take a caller?
Sure.
Okay.
They're still there. They haven't been turned off.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Candace, very patiently waiting. Candace, hello there.
I guess I got all the questions with the Kundalini. I mean, everything was answered. I really didn't even have anything to say about the Kundalini. That's wow, that was very interesting. But I am actually a little bit younger, and I don't think that I'm maybe ready for that Kundalini opening. I guess being 31 years old and everything, I'm not done with having a sexual adventure. I'm sorry.
Candace, if I may, there's nothing to prevent you from learning to meditate and practicing yoga and just preparing. You don't have to go all the way. Just like you don't have to go all the way in your first sexual encounter, you don't have to go all the way with this, if you get the gist of what I'm trying to say. So, and that can work wonders on you, because it can prepare you for the shift and kind of get you mentally and physically and psychically prepared through your life, so that when the time comes, you'll know that time and you'll recognize it and either move forward or not.
Yeah, because I'm going through a little something right now, dealing with somebody, and I had a very, very strong connection with this person, and it just seems like, everything, including my... because I'm a person, I meditate. I meditate every day, twice a day. And it's been a lot of, even with this person, it's like I'm really connected to this person in a way. It's like I can pick up from things like what they're, it's very interesting. It's just like I could communicate with that person on a level that, I don't know, kind of telepathically. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if this is something that, you know, is it me just in my head, or is this something that's going on, which is I don't understand, especially because, first of all, I've never even experienced a kind of connection with this person, with somebody, anybody else. I've never even experienced that. And secondly, I'm not understanding this is something from doing a lot of healing. I'm still working on this everyday process with healing and everything, but it's sort of since I don't understand why is it that I can connect with that person on that kind of a level, and I've never connected that way with anybody else.
Well, I don't understand it either because I don't know you, but it sounds like you have certain, at least, propensities towards this type of self-knowledge. And one of the big features in self-knowledge is meeting the right people at the right time. Now, the bulk of the work probably has to be accomplished individually, but that doesn't mean that along the road somewhere you're going to meet these people that just come into your life and as elucidators that somehow shed light on where you should go, or they reinforce your thinking, or they steer you in a way, not by giving you, telling you what you're doing is the wrong way, but just by supporting somehow. Does that sound clear?
Yeah, because it's brought up a lot of my creativity in a kind of way, in a sense, but it's like he's also empathic as well. And so we pick up a lot on each other. You know, like, I can even tell if something's, I don't even have to be on the phone with this person, or I could be miles or hundreds of miles from this person, and I can feel something, and I can know something's wrong with that person, with him. Or he does the same with me as well.
Right.
And so it's just like, okay, what the heck is this? You know, I have a daughter. I'm not able to do that with her. So I don't know what is this or what's going on. So
Have you ever heard of Edgar Cayce?
Edgar Cayce? I have heard of.
You might like reading his books because he was probably the 20th century's most complete, I don't know, psychic, that if that's the right term. But I think you might enjoy reading him because he has a lot of detailed information and experiences and cases where he was able to connect with people and was actually that was his business. He did that for a while.
Oh wow!
And he was very astute, and he made these connections between people that didn't even know each other, and he didn't know them, and he was able to get them together for business or romantic reasons like that. So it's quite interesting.
You know, I would also suggest, Candace, you might be interested. I quite frequently have psychics on my show. If you look at blogtalkradio.com/AuthorDavidClark, you will see a listing of all of my upcoming shows that are already loaded in the studio. And I do have several psychics on. In particular, I would recommend my show with Mary Lou McIntyre, which is coming up on February 19th, she reads the Akashic Records, which are, it's the book of your lives, all of your lives, the total culmination of your lives. And she might be able to shed some light on the connection that you have with this person. And then I have a marvelous psychic from Australia on March 27th. I don't have that loaded up yet, but you might save that date. It's going to be Friday night at 7:30. Her name is Kat Edwards. You can Google her to get information. And then if you look at blogtalkradio.com/author David Clark with an E, you'll see some other psychics that I will be having on over the course of the next month and a half.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Did you have any other questions for JJ Simple?
Oh, no. That was very, very insightful on the Kundalini thing. And I will be looking that up and doing more research and stuff on there. Thank you so much for the insight on that. Thank you.
Well, thank you for calling in. We really appreciate your call and support. And please check back in. I have 3 shows a week, Candace. And you're always welcome to call in with questions or for a reading. So I hope that I'll hear from you again.
Thank you. And you will.
Okay,
thank you.
You're welcome. I'm very interested in how Kundalini can increase longevity and the effect that it can have on future generations through DNA. Can you speak to that?
Well, Kundalini overhauls your DNA in the space of one lifetime, just to, as simplistic as I can see it.
Really?
And experience it. Yeah. I mean, it there's somatic and metabolic changes that take place, and sometimes anatomical changes too. Basically, because all of growth energy is transmitted through the nervous system. If we didn't have nerve in our limbs and bodies, we'd remain babies for our whole lives. It's not that the muscle tissue grows spontaneously. It's because of the growth energy that shoots through each limb in the nervous canals, in the nerves. And slowly we grow. The bones, the muscles, the flesh expand. So that's what happens. And if we can do that, then there are memory patterns, DNA memory patterns, that can be conserved in DNA and then passed along to future generations. I think we do this as a matter of course, but this is kind of a jumpstart capability because of a more complete transformation of our somatic and metabolic realities.
What effect does it have on physical healing?
Well, my whole book, practically the whole, just interspersed with the details of my life. The first book also goes into depth on the health issues, and basically,
okay,
it's so, for me, it's so far-reaching that it's very hard for people to believe. But I can summarize it very quickly. Do we have time?
Yes, we do. And we can run a little bit over, so don't worry about the time factor.
All right. Well, when I was sent away to boarding school in Massachusetts at the age of 5. I spent 3 years there. My third year, I was 7 years old, and we used to get dressed up in little football uniforms and have football practice. And then we'd come back and we'd shower in the gym. And one day I was in a towel fight, snapping towel fight with another boy. And I really got him on the butt. And the whole team chased me down the hall because he was like writhing in pain. And I mean, it was an equal fight. My thing just got him really bad. So, and I ran into the wall being chased. I slipped because I was barefoot. We were all naked running down the hall. I don't know, 15 boys or something like that. And I got this splinter from the baseboard into my foot. And when they came up, saw that I had this splinter, they saw that I was bleeding, and they went away and just left me there. So I went back. I rinsed off my foot in the sink, and then I went to the nurse, but I didn't tell her that I had the splinter. I knew the splinter was in there because I could see the missing piece. And I don't know what it was that stopped me from doing this. But I guess I was just scared of a doctor, thought they'd be cutting into my foot, something like that. And within 3 days, I was in the doctor's hospital in New York in a kind of a coma because this thing had started to affect my just about everything. And I didn't tell my mother. And then later on, now I recall maybe telling my mother but swearing her to secrecy. Anyway, finally, the thing healed up. I had to take penicillin. This was back in the 40s. I was taking penicillin, and I was, you know, plasma and everything like that because it wouldn't heal over, this wound. And slowly, it healed back over but sealed inside. And my parents were divorced, and I went down to Florida to live with my father, and he basically didn't know what was going on, and everything started back. But this thing had hit a nexus in my body that warped my growth so that it changed my whole metabolism. And I started growing in a different pattern, in a different way, changing my basic. I was, and three actual worldly manifestations prove this, because I was very good at 7 years old. I was really good at math. I was like the leading singer in the choir, and I was a really good tennis player. I lost all those abilities after that.
Really?
Where I had to learn math all over again, and all of those things are specifically related to symmetry, to physical symmetry, and to the capability of being centered, to the whether you're a horse or a dog or a human, and everything in life, physical attraction, the traits and the faculties and the talents we have are related to symmetry. And from a symmetrical being, I turned into an asymmetrical being. Cut to the it also changed my behavior, and I started to be really erratic, a bad student, self-destructive, and this continued till right through my 20s and my 30s, my relationships with other people, with women, and then all of a sudden, boom, I get into this kind of questing thing and self-knowledge, and finally found Kundalini. As soon as Kundalini activated, it immediately went down to my ankle and started inventorying the whole thing, and then adjusting my body and sending vital nervous energy throughout my body to rebalance my symmetry. And that's been going on for 40 years. And this, most people think, where did this guy come up with this? But this is very accurate. This is absolutely true. And I can feel the energy going to different centers of my body. When I finished the Kundalini activation, I had varicose veins in my right leg. 2 years ago, I felt this energy thing just rippling up and down my leg. The varicose veins are gone now. It's
boy, that's amazing. Wow.
And
well, I had some personal questions, but I'm going to put those aside. You talk in one of your books about the importance of diet, and raw foods and pure air is excellent sources of prana, which for people that don't know what that is, it's a life force energy. Would you speak a little bit about diet, and then I'll have a closing question for you.
Sure. There's a chapter on diet in my book and on in my website on the raw foods. Now, raw foods are, just in a practical sense, it's pretty hard to maintain a raw diet, I have found, since I wrote that, to be perfectly honest. But if you can be 40, 50, 60, 70% raw, all the better. It's just difficult to prepare. It's more difficult to prepare raw food than it is cooked food, because you've got to slice it, you've got to make it so that it's palatable. But it really does. I went on a raw retreat one day, for a week in Sebastopol, California, and I really enjoyed it because they just prepared stuff. There were young people preparing these raw foods. We just ate mainly vegetables, and it just the source of all our major illnesses is located in the gut. That we have colons that are full of crap and coated with stuff that build on the walls of the colon, and that are just their legacy. They've been there for years, and but most of our diseases, most of man's diseases, originate in the gut, and that's why raw foods they just pass easily through our channel, because we really are monkeys to a great degree. We share a lot of that, and they eat fruits and vegetables. And when we eat fruits and vegetables, we're just much healthier. Do you have any experience with that?
Not really. I can't say that I eat a lot of raw foods, and that's why I was very intrigued by that. You know, most of the food I eat is cooked, and so I was wondering about transitioning towards more raw foods and the benefits that would have for me. So that's why I asked the question. You talk about even raw fish.
Well, yeah, sushi is raw, and mm-hmm. Sushi is much easier to. It's hard to digestion. Digestion is to me is very easy. The more raw I eat, the easier my digestion is, and basically, at least the raw foods people, they explain it this way: that we have a limited subset of enzymes for digestion in our body, a finite amount of enzymes. And once they're depleted, then you have to go to buy enzymes at Trader Joe's or wherever and gobble them down. And all different kinds of bacteria, we have to take that to help with digestion because we've depleted the natural enzymes. That also rings true with the life force energy in semen. We have a limited amount in our bodies. And once we deplete that, then that really starts the downhill, starts us on a downhill road to aging very, very quickly.
Wow. Well, thank God I have not I'm not one that ejaculates a lot, so I'm grateful for that, given my history of solid. I had no idea that that could have an effect on the aging process. That's very interesting. I'd like to close asking a question that was asked of you before, and I know you don't like the use of the term spiritual per se. You prefer metaphysical, is that correct?
Yes.
You were asked, what is the most important issue facing the spiritual community today? So, in terms of metaphysics, in the world or in the community of people who are practicing a spiritual life, if you will, what do you think is the most important aspect that we have to deal with today?
Well, sadly, I think it's commercialism, that everybody has their own little empire or their own little subject matter that they want to protect and they want to commercialize. And they're not open to sharing. I'm talking within the Kundalini community, but I think that translates very easily into the whole of the so-called spiritual, metaphysical community, that everybody wants to defend their own thing. They don't want to share. They think that somebody's going to steal their stuff. Well, if they feel that way, they shouldn't be doing this, because you're going to be constantly renewed. With Kundalini, I learn something new every day. I can't protect what I found out 10 years ago or even last night, and I don't try. I share it. I open it. What we could do is to share and to help each other in ways so that people that were good in marketing could do the marketing and people that weren't good in marketing could do the writing and things like that. There's a more of a sharing environment. I think material scientists have learned that things have to be vetted, that they have to be peer processed, you have to have a means of substantiating things. You just can't throw them out there. So we throw out so much stuff in this spiritual thing that has never been proven or vetted. And then we get somebody interested in it, and let's say there's something in it, and somebody else is working in it too, but we don't want to share it. We think, oh, they're going to steal our ideas. Well, ideas are bought and sold in the marketplace. If it's a good idea, it will gather momentum, and you won't have to protect it, and you can actually work together to build on the research capabilities. Like this whole this notion that I put forth of a secret subsystem or a hidden subsystem of the body, that there's so much evidence for this, but it hasn't been approved by material scientists because they can't find the matter that is the actual locus of this subsystem. But we've proved it somewhat empirically, because we know that acupuncture works. The acupuncturists are just using these old charts of Chinese pressure points. Nobody knows how they got there or why they're there. They don't seem to represent the same thing that, like, the heart. We know where the heart is, or we know where the lungs are, or we know how the vascular system works. But we didn't necessarily know about the endocrine system back in the 12th century. So we keep adding layers to this, to our knowledge, and we keep right now. We seem to be in a race to break out of the pack and commercialize and become the latest sensation in the spiritual book world. I don't think that's healthy. I think that people need to share and to vet, to substantiate. A lot of this stuff is seems to be feel-good type things, and people go away feeling good for a couple of days, and then it's back to normal, back to the grind of work and commuting and life with the wife or life with the husband or whatever it is. So the long-term benefits of this are harder to find, harder to substantiate. I think what we're doing with the Kundalini research has actually accomplished a lot of that, but there's a lot of scary aspects to it, or a lot of, let's say, unknown aspects, so it's not for everybody. Not everybody should listen to me or anybody else talk about Kundalini and say, I'm going to do that. They have to weigh the whole life and put it in perspective.
Well, thank you. Just one final point of curiosity. As far as longevity goes, what do you think is the human potential for lifespan if somebody adopts the Kundalini way of life?
Well, let's just look at evolution very briefly. We've evolved from one-cell animals. It's pretty clear. Look at where we are now. It seems like, wow, we've gone a long way. Some people think that we've reached the apex or the pinnacle. To me, I don't even know if we're halfway. We may not even be a quarter of the way. To me, it seems like the natural end game, if there is to be an end game or a foreseeable end game, is a bodiless being. That we no longer need bodies. If without bodies, with just the controlling spirit, no wars, no negative emotion, none of these, the negativity that just rules our daily lives would exist, because we don't need material possessions. So it looks like to me you can build a case, or I can, just extrapolating for an evolution that turns us into bodiless beings, in which case we're just one with that consciousness eternally. There's no there's no lifespan. The lifespan is the lifespan of the body. Now, that you'd have to ask a scientist. They probably know. That's something that material scientists really know a lot about. And I can I can listen to the radio and read stuff on health improvements and longevity, and obviously addiction and harmful substances tie into that, drinking, smoking. But there's got to be a limit for that. Did you ever see the movie Zardoz?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, it's a great movie because it tackles that subject.
How do you spell that?
Zardoz.
Okay. I'll have to see if it's on that.
It's a kind of a muddled movie, but it's in its own way it's great because it kind of tackles that problem.
Okay.
A race of super beings that have grown old, but they're still in these bodies. Their bodies seem to be preserved, but they've disintegrated. Their physical disintegration has influenced their mental capacity, so that they're no longer, and they're served by a race of kind of serfs and that are much more vital. So, yeah, the body is a wonderful thing when you're young and you're in love and blah blah blah, we have a long way to go, I think, in our evolution, and we shouldn't discount the notion of bodiless beings, that just being pure spirit or pure consciousness, and part of an all-encompassing consciousness.
Well, thank you for that. That's a very interesting insight, and I'm inclined to agree with you. I want to thank you for joining me today, and I'll be interested in whatever information you can send my way, and I wish you a pleasant evening.
Well, it's been a real pleasure, David, and I'll get on the internet and I'll assemble a bunch of links, and you can shout them out to your listeners.
Thank you so much. So once again, we come to a close. Now we can pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing of separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who are having a metaphysical experience. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize.
You have been listening to Different Strokes for Different Folks. To find common ground and take it to the next level, here on Blog Talk Radio with David Clark, every Friday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern. You can listen to this broadcast again on srbroadcasting.com.
FreeSpiritBroadcasting.com.